The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Okay, hello. Can everybody hear me? Hey, how are you? Okay, well, it looks like it's about time to start. Maybe. I am Becca Merkel, so thank you so much for coming to the talk. I'm really excited to be here at ACCS. I have actually never been to an ACCS conference since way back in the olden times when they were in Moscow, and I was at the very first one, which I don't know, it was maybe 1993 or something, and I was in high school, and I was making photocopies for people in the back room, and that's my claim to fame. So it's fun to be here and see how different it is. It was in the Logos lunchroom, which is a smaller venue than this one. So I am Doug Wilson's daughter, and so you heard from him already, and my brother Nate is here. You'll hear from him. So the thing to keep in mind is that I am the oldest and most important child. I went to Logos School in Moscow, Idaho. I started my kindergarten year as the first year it opened. I went all the way through Logos, K through 12, in the kind of wild and woolly years when they were figuring things out. And so I went all the way through that, and then I attended New St. Andrew's College in Moscow after that, which also opened the first year I started college. So you can see that my role in life is the guinea pig, and it's my spiritual gift. So then I got married and had kids, and they are all at Logos School now. And my oldest son is going to be a senior this year, so we are very nearly done with two complete laps through Logos, which is really fun. It's such a blessing. A lot of the same teachers are there. My son has been taught by some of the same people I was taught by, which is just phenomenal. It's really fun. And it's great to see, too, what a totally different thing it is for him than it was for me, because the schools continue to grow and get better. So it's wonderful. I started teaching at Logos when my youngest just went into kindergarten. So we have five kids between sixth grade and 12th grade right now. So all of them are there, and it's just really fun to get to teach there and be a part of it from that side as well. So I'm going into my seventh year, I think, this year teaching mostly upper school, upper high school humanities, lit, history, apologetics. So that's kind of what I'm going to be focusing on in my talk. I'm sure some of it, you know, applies lower down as well, like some of the stuff you could really apply in junior high. But I'm kind of thinking juniors and seniors when I talk, and humanities. I'm not a math teacher, so this applies more to that. So we are here at a conference on classical education, so I think it's safe to say we all have the same goals, you know, as far as what we want our students to graduate like. We want them to be strong, independent thinkers who know what they believe, they know why they believe it, they can defend it, they can articulate it, they're persuasive about it. Also, we want it to be the right thing that they believe. That would be a bonus. We want them to be grounded in the truth, to stand in the truth, to love the truth. And I think that that's probably a safe assumption, that everybody here is wanting that for their own children, for their students. But sometimes I think it's easy to accidentally produce something else, you know, something other than what you're doing, than what you intend to do. So I think that given that that is our goal, it's not a very profound observation to say that we want the students to know the truth and love the truth, so we want them to actually believe it. Like, we want their opinions to be those things that we think are true. That's not terribly profound. So I think it's worth taking a minute then to just think about how do we shape their actual opinions. It's easy to teach them to say the right things. It's harder to get them to truly think it themselves for themselves and to own it. That's a tougher job. So I want to start with things that could potentially go wrong. Classical education is wonderful. I think it produces great results. But at the same time, you know, everything can go off the rails sometimes. And when things go pear-shaped, I think they kind of do it in some predictable ways. So I wanted to hit just a few of the things that we've seen where, you know, the classical education movement can produce a particular kind of problem. And the first one that I have on your outline is the problem of posers. And so what is a poser? What do I mean by a poser? We all know the, you know, we recognize it. It's all over the place. It's the boy who stands, you know, and folds his arms and squishes his biceps out, you know, and stands there looking at them to make sure he's coming across very impressively, or the girl who's striking poses that worked better in the mirror at home than they do in the grocery store. So it's somebody who's really trying to project something, and they're very caught up in how they're projecting it. And so they always have sort of one eye on themselves as they're doing it. It's like they really care how the audience sees them, so they become part of the audience, looking at themselves, judging how this is coming across. There was a guy who cut my hair one time who was awesome because he would talk to himself in the mirror. Like he was talking to me down here as he's up there, and he would just make eye contact with himself the whole time. So he would be trying to tell a story, and he'd stop and get all caught up. But he's looking at himself in the mirror the whole time, and I'm down here thinking, this is weird. But it's people who do that. It's like they're constantly looking in the mirror. They're always in their own peripheral vision checking how this is playing, right, in front of the crowd. And people do this all over the place. This is not a problem with classical education. This is a problem with humans. So people strike poses all the time, athletic poses or fashion poses or intellectual poses. And because this is such a common human thing to do, I think we should be aware that this is going to be a temptation for some students. And just keep that in mind and try and prevent it from happening. Because we obviously don't want to create a bunch of fakers. That's not the goal. You know, you want to graduate students who truly own this and they believe it and they love it. You don't want students who are pretending because it, you know, plays well. And I also think that academia in particular can be very prone to this. And I know we're all dealing with, you know, teenagers and below, mostly, but it starts young. I think academia can actually, people can get away with it far more in academia, particularly in the humanities, because it's much easier to fake big words than to actually pretend to be good at basketball when everyone can see that you're not, or like, I pretend that I run fast when it's like, nobody thinks that. So, but you can fake this sort of pseudo-intellectual thing much more easily, and I think you can dupe people more easily with it. So it's a problem in academia all the way up, interestingly, because my husband got his doctorate at Oxford, and so we lived in Oxford for 3 years, and you would think by the time people got there they could stop pretending, but no, they don't. And it actually almost increases the further up you get. And so the temptation to, you know, fluff up your feathers and try and seem bigger than you are goes all the way up. So, yeah, we saw that. One interesting thing was when he was defending his dissertation, you know, you have to get up and defend it in front of, you know, whoever. And somebody gave Ben a piece of advice that I thought was just really profound, actually, about human nature in general. He said, you actually really want the top scholars to be the ones examining you. You do not want the B-list guys, you want the world-renowned scholars because they have nothing to prove and they have no chip on their shoulder. It's the B-list guys that will be brutal because they want to just really show you that they are bigger than you and that they are smarter and they have something to prove. So they really go there. And I think that that's true across the board, but in academia it can be a bigger thing. So you have people who can talk like absolute blah and convince people that they're smart. You know, so they can be saying things like, my current work looks at not only the contours of value, but also the inherent urgency we see in the multiplicity of human endeavors, which coalesces in the emergent complexity so common in modern society, but presciently noted in Heidegger's philosophical hermeneutics. You know, and everything's, ooh, all right then. Wow for you. You know, and it means nothing. I mean, just absolutely nothing, but it can intimidate people. And then they get a lot of, you know, respect that way. And for every real intellectual, there are dozens of fake ones who just copy the tweed jacket or they copy the favorite authors or they copy the pipe or whatever. And then they try and get the respect that way. And obviously, we don't want to be producing those kinds of students. High school students don't fake it quite as well as, you know, people who've been at it longer, but you don't want them to be striking poses all the time and looking at themselves being smart. You want them to actually love what you're teaching them. And we want them to actually love it, not just get good at pretending to love it. And we want to produce the real thing, not the counterfeit, which means we almost need like a teacher version of that marker they swipe on the $100 bills, you know, just to see, like, do you mean it or do you not mean it? We want to shape the actual opinions of the students, not just train them to pretend like they believe this stuff. And then we can think, why does it matter, though, really? I mean, if we train them to say the right things, we've gotten them to say the right things, and that will surely benefit them. And I don't think that's true, actually. I think it's really dangerous to train them to say the right things if they don't mean it, because essentially someone who has gotten good at that is, in principle, a chameleon. So in your class, they figure out what to say to get a good grade, to get the respect, to get you to think that they're smart, and they figure out the right way to do it, and you have just trained them to say the right thing to get the respect, and then you plunk them in a secular university classroom, and what are they going to do? They're going to say what they need to say to get the respect, right, or to get the accolades or whatever. So someone who forms their opinions based on crowd appeal is someone who's going to continue to do it outside of your classroom. So it is far more important that you figure out that than that you get them to parrot back the right worldview questions. Because you can get kids who will say all the right things, they know all the right answers, and not a single bit of it has actually gone in, right? They somehow manage to, it's like they're wearing a rain jacket the whole time. You know, none of it gets on them. They manage to say it, but they don't mean it. And clearly we don't want to be producing that. The second thing that I think can go wrong is a sort of jaded disinterest in all of it. That, like, I hate this. I can't wait to get out of here. I have been there, done that, not interested. Right? And so we'll see, you know, you see grads from classical schools who they don't love it at all. They don't love what they've been taught. They just can't wait to move on. And I think out of the three problems I've listed in your outline, that one's the easiest to identify. And it's the easiest to see it as a problem. I think teachers can frequently get duped by the first kind. You know, they think, oh, what an amazing kid, and he just seems so interested, and he's so smart, and he says all the right things. And so teachers can fall for the poser. It's very hard to fall for this kid, you know, the surly little punk who sits there and lets you know that he thinks everything you're saying is worthless. And usually that's not your favorite student. They're easy to pick out, these guys, and they are also easy to see. As a teacher, it's easy to see that that's a problem. The third one, the sort of detached intelligence, what I mean by that is, like, producing the kind of student who graduates with top SAT scores, great scholarship offers, you know, prestigious college offers, and no particular worldview to speak of, no real loyalty to the things they've learned, but they've gotten a great education out of it. And that's obviously not ideal either, right? So that kid might just as well have gone to an Ivy League prep school that had no worldview of any kind. It's just there to give you sort of a good jumping off place to your future career. And the thing is, though, is that smart people are a dime a dozen. Like, producing smart people is not all that exciting. Our country doesn't need more intelligent people. It needs more principled people. That is far more the need of the hour. And it's not that good of a trick to produce smart kids. You know, like I said, the Ivy League prep school can do that too. And so I think that that's something that can happen with classical schools because it's such a great education. It comes with all those benefits, right? If you give the kids this great education, they do end up being National Merit Scholars and they have the SAT scores and they do get scholarship offers. And so that's a great benefit, but it shouldn't be the end goal, right? We're looking for something beyond that. So then what kinds of classrooms could potentially create those problems, those three that I've just listed, the posers, the sort of disinterested kid, and then the intelligent kid, but, you know, who's not particularly oriented to the worldview side of things. We've probably all seen students like this, and I do think it's safe to say none of us are aiming for that, right? So what are the things that we do as teachers that could end up inadvertently producing these things? And I should also note, obviously, there are more factors than just you, the teacher, right? The kid could be surly because his dad abandoned the family, and that's not something that is your fault. So I'm kind of like excluding all of those things. You know, the family stuff, the church stuff, all of those things are hugely important. But it is true that teachers play a major role. So I'm kind of assuming, okay, you have a class of good kids, it's a good school, and they don't have to turn out this way, right? What are the things that we can do that will either shape them well or will push them away or push them into fakiness? So the posers. Let's talk about the posers first. This one's pretty easy. You will get posers if you reward posing. It's a pretty basic thing. Kids want to get good grades, and they will do what it takes to get the good grade. And so if you're the kind of teacher that rewards it, and again, inadvertently, it's not like any of us wake up and think what this world needs is a few more fakers. What can I do to produce it? You know, like, we're not consciously doing that, but at the same time, if we reward it, that's what we're going to end up producing. So what are ways that we might do that? The first two things, I would say, are more personal issues for the teacher. And then the second two, I'll give you four things that I think could go wrong. The first two, personal. The second two, more teaching style, teaching method. The first one is if we're posers ourselves. You know, that's pretty simple. If you have a teacher who's a poser, it's not surprising that they're going to get a classroom full of posers. So that could be simple things like pretending you know more than you do, right? And kids see that. Like, kids become like their teachers, and they will see what you're doing, and they'll figure out that, oh, that's how we behave here. We pretend like we know more than we actually know. If we're more interested in, I guess if we're less interested in the material than we are in watching ourselves be interested in the material, that's a problem. You know, like, I feel like I'm being so profound right now. I think the students are feeling how smart I am. I think the students know that this is deep, what I'm saying. You know, if you've got, like, this eye on yourself, and I think sometimes, you know, I don't know, there's sort of younger teachers that can have this ideal of them being Anne of Green Gables, you know, just shaping the students. And they're more interested in themselves being Anne of Green Gables than they are in the material that they're actually trying to teach. And they like to see themselves in this role as a mentor or, you know, whatever it is. But it's like we're looking at ourselves in our peripheral vision the entire time. And so if we tend towards that, then we're going to end up creating that in our students because the students do become, they pick up on what the teacher is like sometimes far more deeply than they pick up on the things the teacher is saying. So if we're always watching ourselves out of the corner of our eye, then that's what we're going to be teaching our students to be like. Second thing we could do wrong is just being gullible, right? Like, you want the kids to be interested in the material, so when they say they are, you think, yay. And you don't have that little bit of cynicism that thinks, I don't know if you're telling me the truth right now. One time, a few years ago, there was a new teacher at Logos who was very young, kind of starry-eyed idealist. And she was in the teacher's room. It was her first year. And I remember her just being like, oh, the seventh graders are just so wonderful and they're so interested and I just love it. They're just their little faces and they're just shining with, you know, she was going on. And the teacher who had them the previous year, who was a very old seasoned teacher, she was like, they are wonderful students, but I have to tell you, they are the sneakiest batch that I have ever taught. She's like, they are devious. Okay, that's funny. That's like the difference between, you know, the teacher who's just so excited about it and is just, they don't have the little bit of cynicism. It was a Ronald Reagan who said, trust but verify. And so actually this last year I teach a rhetoric class to sophomores, and there was this kid who, I can't even remember what the discussion was. It might have been socialism. I'm not really sure. We were trying to do just a debate. So I presented both sides, and then I was asking the kids, okay, what do you think? Just before we had discussed it at all. And I called on this one kid, and I'm like, what do you think? And he told me, he's like, I think it's this one. And I said, oh, why? And he goes, because it looked like you thought that was the right answer. And I was like, no, it's the worst. And it's not like I'm going to shout at him, like, you conniving little beast. Because, you know, he wants to get the right answer. It's not like he's trying to be devious. But at the same time, like, if I had said, everyone, did you hear that? That was wonderful. Well done. You know, he doesn't believe it. So when I say why, he's like, I don't know. I thought that seemed like you wanted me to say it. And you don't want to create a class that rewards that sort of thing, because then they will just start to think that that's what it looks like. That's what you need to do, is just try and, you know, do the sort of spit test, see where the wind is blowing, and then say that. So anyway, don't be gullible. Don't just believe the students necessarily. Poke at it a little bit and find out, do you really think that? And why do you think that? And give me some reasons why you think that. And just prod at it a little bit. So the next two things, I think those are personal things. Like, if we are posers or if we are gullible, we can end up having this problem. But I think another thing is if we only reward our own opinion in class. Now, if you're teaching math, then reward your own opinion, you know. But the answers are right or they're wrong. But I teach lit, and so if I insist that everyone in the class have the same likes and dislikes, the same feelings about the book that I have, then I am insisting that they say things they don't actually believe. And if I reward it with points on the test, then they will learn they need to say things they don't actually think just to get the points on the test. And students want to get good grades for the most part, so they'll do it. So let's say we're studying A Tale of Two Cities. And I spend a whole lot of time, we talk about what did Dickens think of the revolution, and look how he's actually completely channeling Percy Shelley here, and Percy Shelley was very pro-revolution, and let's compare the two, and let's see what he's getting from this, and, you know, and how does he say it, and what are quotes from Dickens that really show us that actually he is far more sympathetic to the revolution than you might first think. You know, we spend all sorts of time, and then I ask him an essay question on the test. What does Dickens think of the revolution, and how does this relate to Shelley? And then let's say I get a kid who says, that's baloney. I don't think it was at all. I think he was very anti-revolution. Now, if I mark him wrong for that, and I think, well, he was obviously not listening in class. If I mark him wrong for that, then I am teaching him that in order to succeed in my class, it doesn't matter what you think. It matters that you repeat back to me what I said. And that is a horrible thing to do to your students. And so you might think initially, like, well, he wasn't paying attention in class, so clearly he needs to be docked, and he has a wrong view about Dickens. But the thing is, you can get him to say the right thing about Dickens, but he still has the wrong view about Dickens. And then you have layered on top of that a little lesson in hypocrisy, and that is far more damaging to his soul than having a goofy view of Tale of Two Cities. You know, like, really, in the end, that's not going to hurt him. But teaching him to be a little hypocrite, that will hurt him. And so if, as teachers, we only reward what we want to hear, then I think we can unwittingly be doing that to the students. And so I think that one place that this can get us is if we take offense kind of at it. Like if we say, wasn't this a wonderful book and it was just amazing, and then they write a little essay about how this was dorky and I didn't like it at all, and then we get our backs up and ding them for it, then you're training them in hypocrisy. And the thing that you should ding them for is if they don't have good reasons, or it looks like they didn't read the book, or they're not tying their opinion to the text, or whatever. But I am far more leery of the kid who gives me an essay where he just said exactly what I said in class, including my own examples. That always cracks me up, as if I've not heard that one before. So anyway, when the student gives me that, that's when I feel like, I don't know what you think, actually. The student who will disagree with me in the essay is like, okay, that's good job. And now we can talk about it. Like, we can talk about your opinion. But I can't shape the opinion if I don't know what it really is, right? If the students are just giving me what I want to hear, I've got no idea what's going on in their head. And I can't shape it then, right? As my dad is fond of saying, you can't steer a parked car. You've got to get it out, like figure out what they're saying, what they're thinking, what their actual instincts are, and then you can try and work on it, and then you can worry about getting them to have the correct opinion. But yeah, first getting them to have an opinion at all can sometimes be the uphill battle, or to at least let you know what their opinion is can be hard. So I think that this happens, too, when we forget that we're supposed to be teaching the students how to think, and we instead start focusing on teaching them what to think, right? And in our heads, it makes sense, right? Because we think, if I teach them how to think correctly, they will come to these conclusions, and I have tested them, and they have these conclusions, therefore I have taught them to think correctly, which, of course, is a logical fallacy, right? If you were to graph it out, that's a logical fallacy, affirming the consequent. But it's also very easy to slip into because that first premise is true. If I teach them how to think correctly, they will come to correct conclusions in the end. But it's so much easier to test for the correct conclusions than it is to test, because it's like, how do you test? Are you thinking very clearly right now? It's very hard, you know, a fill-in-the-blank kind of thing, or just give me the essay that, you know, summarizes what I said in class. That's easy. You can test for that. But it's so much harder to access the other that I think we tend to slip into that. And we also think, like, well, obviously I've taught him how to think, because, look, he said all the right things. I think, actually, another way of stating this problem is to say we've forgotten what the trivium actually is. Right? So in the early years, you're supposed to be packing those kids full of facts, right? Just stuff their sticky little brains full of facts and charts and graphs and principal exports. Just do all those things, all the math facts. But once they transition, they're older, you're supposed to be trying to train how they think. You're training the process. And I think when we slip into this, what we're actually doing is we're treating them like grammar students again. It's like, here, memorize this worldview. Repeat the worldview back to me, gold star for you, and then move on. So rather than focusing on what's going on behind the scenes in your head, it's so much easier to just make them spit back the right thing. But that's really grammar level stuff. That's not rhetoric level. And so I think when we goof up the trivium sometimes, and rhetoric teachers are acting like grammar teachers, that's where this can go wrong. And then actually the last one is another way of forgetting the trivium, but almost in reverse, I think. The one I just described is where you're treating rhetoric like grammar stage. Just repeat it back. Just give me the right answer. But the fourth thing I think we can do that creates the poser is when we start to treat the students like show poodles. And I think that this can happen in classical schools, again, because you've got all these good little kids who are smart and they can say really smart-sounding things, and look at them doing their Latin chants. And so we start treating the little kids like show poodles, and we start giving them things that are far too advanced for them. And so it's like in our school, the fourth graders are reading Boethius and City of God, and it's amazing. And the thing is, you can teach them to say smart things about City of God, and all the rich donors will think you're amazing. But the truth is, they're not ready for that. They've got no idea what City of God is about. And all you've done is you've told them that education is about putting on an act – and about being a little show poodle. And I think that classical schools can tend to do that because it is true that this education produces amazing results that are so far ahead of what is going on in the public schools, just, you know, running laps around it. But then it's like it becomes this little race, you know, where it's like the goal becomes we're going to do so much better, so much faster. And so consolation of philosophy in fourth grade, there you go. And they don't know what's going on. And so the thing is, you're teaching them, you're training them to just show off. And that happens when the school has started to just show off. So when the school starts, you know, being impressed with the articles about themselves in the newspaper or how it looks when they walk the donors through the halls and when they see the kids saying all these smart things, the school is just showing off. The school is being a poser. And so, of course, that's what you're going to produce is a bunch of kids who think that's what we do is we do little tricks and we pose for people. So anyway, I think those are two sort of teaching style things. And I think both of them come down to forgetting the trivium sometimes and just doing the wrong thing in the wrong place. So then the second problem, that of jaded disinterest, I think those are things we can do that, that create the little poser problem. But interestingly, I think the jaded, the kid who never wants to hear any of this again, I think it's the exact same things. I think it's the identical recipe that just produces a different result in some cases. And it's not the same recipe because you have a different student. So you have some kids who are just going to be irritated by it. Some kids who are going to see through it. Other kids who are willing to perform, they're willing to do the thing. And there's other students who just hate it. Right? They dislike the posing and they see through the posing. So the first thing, the teacher who poses himself, right? The poser teacher and the teacher who's always acting like he knows more than he does or is always kind of full of himself or whatever, that's just going to irritate some kids. And so some of the kids are going to be just in awe of your amazing intellect and other students are going to sit there in the back, you know, like spitting out the side of their mouth. And they just want to get out of here and be done with this charade, right? So it can be the same teacher and you can produce two very different things based on what the student, you know, what they tend to like themselves. Second, the gullible teacher, right? The teacher that just falls for it when the kid says whatever the thing is like, oh, I too love Dante. And the kid in the back is like, you do not, you little, you know, weasel. And then when the teacher falls for it and goes for it and bites, then it just annoys the other kid, right? Who's just like, whatever, get me out of here. I don't want any more to do with this. So I think that can also be something that produces both the poser and the jaded student. Rewarding only the same opinion. Okay, again, you've got some students who will perform for you. When you say jump, they'll say how high, and that's, you know, that's just how they're going to be. And then you've got other students who are just aggravated by a teacher that wants them to parrot this stuff back, especially in the rhetoric phase when the students are wanting to kind of express themselves. They're wanting to have their own opinions. They're wanting to be able to do that. And if you won't let them, you're just going to, you know, irritate them. And then they want nothing more to do with it. And then you'll end up producing students who just can't wait to wash their hands of this whole thing and get out of here. The show poodle thing, of course, you know, some kids will be just so flattered, you know, everyone thinks I'm so smart. And then you've got the other kid who's just, you know, the inevitable backlash will happen later and they will just resent the whole thing, resent what they were given. They don't want to do it anymore and they'll just chuck it and leave. Okay, the detached intelligence problem. I think this just happens when the school itself forgets what the point of it all is, right? Because, again, it's such an amazing education. It does produce lots of national merit scholars and great SAT scores, and the statistics are amazing, and all of our graduates go to college, and it's going to be this, you know, it's great, and then the school sort of forgets what the point of it was. That's a side benefit. That is not the end goal. But when the school kind of gets caught up in the feathers in the cap, the point of this education is you're going to get great scholarship offers. You're going to get amazing test scores. You're going to get into top colleges. And then you're going to make lots of money. You know, when the school forgets it and starts treating education as if that's the point of it all, then, of course, you're going to get students who, you know, They won't make trouble. They'll be good students. But they're not going to have, you know, really internalized the worldview thing. This is just a stepping stone for them. Okay, so the importance of personal opinions, why does it matter anyway, right? If you can get them to say the right thing, who cares? But opinions really define us, if you think about it. One time I was talking to a nurse at a hospital who was telling me, I thought this was really interesting. She said, if you show a little kid a picture of their foot and you say, what is that? They'll say, that's my foot. If you show them a picture of their hand, they'll say, that's my hand. If you show them a picture of their face, they say, that's me. So it's like that really, it's different than that's my elbow, right? And in many ways, that's what our opinions are. They define us, right? They define your loves. They define your loyalties. They are you, right? What you believe is you in many ways. And so if we want to shape the kids' opinions, we have to figure out where they actually are, and they can be very good at hiding them for a number of reasons. But you have to be able to actually sort of tap into it. And the thing is, having a defensible opinion is actually hard work. And the students know that, and it's so much easier to just write it down. Just, you know, I memorized it, I wrote it down, are you happy? Right? Instead of actually having to defend their own opinions, which is very difficult sometimes, especially if you have a wrong one, then it's really hard. So it's thinking is so much harder than memorizing, that the students kind of don't want to, right? And also, because opinions really define us, they actually can be potentially very tender, right? And they want to keep you back from it. And so they can be very good at trying to keep you at arm's length. And the truth is if you can't actually defend your opinions, then you're going to end up having to defend your opinions by keeping everyone away from them, right? If you can't actually defend them logically, then you're going to have to defend them some other way, which is, I'm not going to let you know what they are, and I'm going to keep you at a distance. So if we don't really work to try and peel back the layers and figure out what is actually going on in the kids' heads, we won't be able to actually shape them at all. And we don't want to graduate students who have managed to carefully shield their true beliefs and they have gotten through the gauntlet, you know, without ever having to give up what they actually think about the world. So for lots of reasons, kids potentially don't want to air their true opinions. It's hard work, for one. It's potentially embarrassing, right? Because they can be very self-conscious at this age, and they're just not really sure. They want to express themselves, but they're also worried about what everybody might think of them if they do. So it's hard work. It's potentially embarrassing, and you might actually have to change your mind. And so for all of these reasons, they don't really want to do it. So oftentimes in my classes, if I'm pushing the kids and I'm asking them questions, like, you tell me, what do you think about this? They'll get so irritated. And they'll be, just tell us the answer. Why don't you just tell us the answer? You know, and why do you keep asking us? We don't know. And so anyway, and it's like, well, that's kind of the point, is I want to figure out what you think. It's not about, and they will say, just tell us the answer and we will write it down. And I'm like, right, and you'll put it on the test and it will have never have gotten into your fat little head. in terms of practical solutions, I'm always trying to figure out ways to crack this nut, you know? It's like, I feel like there's classes where I just never have gotten it with them. And so for the last, 6 years that I've taught, I feel like I'm always sort of trying new things to try and figure out how to get in there. And each class is so different that you've got a new challenge every year, and it's not going to be the same thing that's going to work that worked last year. So this last year, my junior class was a big vocal class that has no problem sharing their opinions and speculating about things and talking about things, and it's fantastic. I mean, most of the time I'm sort of like, hey, wait up, guys, you know. And then I have had other classes who, I mean, you cannot get them to talk to save your life. I mean, it is so hard. And there's so many dynamics, you know. It could be like, you know, one kid, sometimes one kid is absent for a day, and it's like you've got a completely different class on your hands. Like, there's this sort of unspoken rule that when he's in the room, we just don't say what we think. Whatever. So there's lots of different dynamics. So I've kind of come up with various ways that I've found that tend to work to get past some of those things. So, yeah, lots of trial and error, different experiments, things that didn't work. But one of the things for the teacher is you can never take offense, honestly. If you take offense at a student for any reason whatsoever, you've lost. And so it is so important to stay jolly and stay interested and don't get your back up and don't get chippy and brittle, right? And if you resort to your authority and you resort to, you will show me some respect, you've lost. Like, you just really, hands down, it doesn't matter. You can get the class to shut up. You can get them to write the right answer, but you have lost every one of them. So you can't ever take offense. And I think it's funny, but I think actually teachers can be so susceptible to high school peer pressure still. I have this theory that everyone in the world is scared of high school students, except for this one brief shining moment when they're in college and you can sort of look down on the high school students. But then, like, I don't know, the fear returns. And so high school students are scared of high school students. You know, junior high students are scared of high school students. And then middle-aged people are so scared of high school students. And so, like, trying to find a sub at Logos, there's this sub list of parents, you know, that you can call through. No one wants to teach high school. And I'm like, it's there. It's the fear. And except mothers of high school students, they're like, whatever, I'm fine. Anyhow, I think if a teacher can be sort of cool shamed, right? Like, I think this is a really neat poem. And then when the whole class looks at you like, then it can be very easy to just feel like kind of embarrassed or something. And so then you resort to your authority, right? And you come down like, I will just be the voice from on high. You must like this poem, or at least write me an essay that acts like you do. And I think that that's just an insecurity in the teacher. Like, you have to be willing to be like, oh, you thought it was a stupid book. Why is that? And then take them seriously. Like, if somebody says, this is the dumbest book of all time, then talk to them about it. You know, don't just say, you be quiet and, you know, which it can be easy to do, especially if the kid is a punk, right? Just shut them up. But the thing is, you can't take offense. You have to be able to engage with it, but you always have to win. That's the other trick. I think a lot of times teachers don't want to engage because they don't know if they'll win or not. So, but if you stay jolly, then that is a huge, huge benefit, right? If you get irritated, if you get crabby, then you've lost the whole class, not just the one, right? And especially if you land on that kid, then even the students in there who probably would have gone with you on the actual subject, it's like, whatever, he got mad and that's fine. So don't take offense. Also, one other thing I have found, one punk student in the class can be awesome. Like, just cherish that student. They are such a weapon in your little tool belt. So having one punk student can be so good for the overall class dynamic, and it can be a pain because usually those kids are a pain. But the thing is you can actually get a class discussion going that way. So because like I said, it's sometimes hard to get them to air their opinions. If you got one kid in there who says, this is stupid, and then you actually take the time to engage with that, it can be the way in, right? You can actually get the other students to chime in and to come with you on it. So don't shut up the punk kid. I mean, unless he's, you know, swearing at you or something. But you know what I mean? Like, don't shut him up just for saying, this is dumb. Like, I hate Pride and Prejudice. Make them defend it. Like, and make them defend it from the text. And then you'll get other kids coming out of the woodwork to argue with him. And so it can be a huge asset to have one kid. So we had this hilarious class discussion this last year over a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem. And, you know, to be honest, to get a high school class interested in Gerard Manley Hopkins, uphill battle a little bit. But having one student who was like, this is so dumb and it's so wordy and there's no point in writing a book about, or writing a poem about a hawk. And so then we start, you know, you start trying to pull it out, and then all of a sudden other kids start coming in on it, and then they all actually develop an opinion about the poem. And that is huge. And if nobody had voiced that opinion, they would have all read it and been like, okay, on to the next thing. But by the end of that discussion, because of the one little soulless creature in the corner, because of that student, it was like, actually, that poem showed up in the valedictorian speech at graduation, because it was like they stopped and they had to actually engage with it. So never shut up that kid. I mean, unless they're being a discipline problem. But you know what I mean? Like, don't confuse a differing opinion with a discipline problem. And I think one of the things I'll get to, but one of the things that I always make them, the title of the talk, Opinions and Fussing, you know, I will say, that's not an opinion, that's a fuss. Like, if you just say, this is a stupid book, and I say, why is it a stupid book? And they say, because the plot is unbelievable, and the characters are ridiculous, and the dialogue is just embarrassing. Then I think, okay, you have reasons, you know. And I might disagree with them, but at least they're reasons. If they say, this is a stupid book, and I say, how come? And they say, because it's dumb. I say, that's not an opinion, that's a fuss. You know, like, that's, if you don't have a reason, then that's where it is. But the teacher has to know the difference too. And you can't treat a valid opinion, even if it's wrong, like it is a fuss. Like, don't land on a kid for complaining. Engage with their actual opinion. And by doing that, you're going to be able to, even if you never win that kid over, he leaves just as much a punk as he ever was. You will have probably gotten a lot more out of your other students because of that one. So be the devil's advocate to everyone, even the ones who agree with you. So in my rhetoric class, I would make the kids come up and defend things, whatever, and I'd make them pick sides in a debate, and I'll get to how I do that in a minute. But they'd come up to the podium, and it didn't matter. They could have been 100% correct on their opinion, and I will take the other side and just argue with them and see if they mean it, you know? And when they're wrong, they come up to the front and they are trying to be a little, you know, whatever, socialist or something. And it's awesome because the sophomores have no idea. And so they will say the awfulest things. they've never thought of socialism before. So that's a great idea. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we should. Anyway, the bugs get worked out of the system, but their intuitions are often wrong. Anyway, so come up to the front and always pick the other side and argue with them, especially maybe the ones who have the right answer, right? And so just make sure that they actually believe it, that they know how to believe it, because maybe they really do, but they don't know why. Maybe they are just doing the thing because they think it'll give them a good grade. But whatever the case, just be the devil's advocate. Take the other side. So some days I would come in and I'm the socialist and you all have to, you know, convince me I'm wrong, or I'm the atheist today. Can any of you, you know, take me? So anyhow, be the devil's advocate. That can be a really helpful way of forcing them to engage. And then surprise the students sometimes. So I think they often will think that they know what you're going to say about things. And it's always useful when you can surprise them a little bit. So, for instance, I don't like John Milton. I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to say it. And I have to teach John Milton, but I don't love him. And so if I say to the students, like, yep, we're reading Paradise Lost, I don't really love it, they'll be like, what? You are the teacher. You're supposed to love it. And but the thing is that can actually be very surprising. I have the most amazing rate of Milton appreciators, like, in the nation. Because when I say, I don't like Milton, they all come back and they're like, this is really good. It's great. So it's really funny. They actually, I've got so many kids who are just diehard Milton fans. I'm like, why? Why? Anyway, so, but that can be useful too, like, to say, this book, like, yeah, it's a classic, but it shouldn't have been. So being able to express your opinion and then give them good reasons why, that shows them, you know, sometimes that it's okay if you disagree with C.S. Lewis. That's the problem. I disagree. It's a bad place to be. It's out on the skinny branches. I know that. But anyway, I can't help it. So developing opinions in young or quiet classes. So this is what I tend to do with sophomores or older classes who just won't talk, right? They're just so quiet and they won't do anything. Or young students who just haven't quite figured it out yet. So some of the things I do there. Now, the goal for me is to get them comfortable expressing their opinions. Like, sometimes you feel like, oh, and now I've created a monster. But once you get there, then you can worry about getting them to have the correct opinion. But you first have, it's like turning up this hard ground sometimes to just get them to the point where they will talk. So young classes or quiet classes, this is what I've done, sample debates. So I got another teacher to come in and debate me on Milton, actually. She loved Milton and I don't. And so we would debate a debate in front of the class. And then you're almost forcing the students to pick sides because it's like, oh, my word, it's my two teachers, and who's winning, you know. And so then it makes them kind of decide, I think her arguments were better or, you know, whatever. So it's like a way of making them, you know, engage in some way. So I've done that before. Unhelpfully, that teacher moved away, so I can't do that anymore. So they can vicariously take sides. It's sort of risk-free. Right? They can sit there and take sides, but then they go out and talk about it afterwards, which is helpful. It's like who had a better, a better argument. So informal class-wide debates. When I say informal, it's because I think that getting them to actually say what they think, if you have a formal debate and assigned topics and assigned sides and you're the rebuttal and you've got 2 minutes, it's like acting. Right? They just have to put together the argument. It doesn't matter if they think it or if they don't think it. They can just, whatever. So I try and keep it more informal so you can actually get what you want to get out of it. I mean, there's a place for formal debate. I don't mean that. But just in terms of accessing what they think, trying to do it informally. So I've done King of the Mountain debates before where I get one student to come up to the podium and they have 2 minutes to present whatever, you know. And then I will just randomly pick a kid. He has to come up, and they have to go at it. And then the class says who won, and then that kid sits down, and then the other one, you know, and I just call him up. And so it's like a little round-robin thing. But it gets, you know, it's more spontaneous, kind of. And it gets the students involved, and they think it's funny, especially if it's a silly topic, you know. But it's just getting them to be able to do it. Blind votes. I would do this in the sophomore class. So I would come in, and like on socialism, I would present one side and I present the other side. I'm like, okay, we're going to vote. And the problem is if they all vote, they look around before they put their hand up, you know. So I tried. I'd be like, all right, you shut your eyes, put your hands up, and you've got peekers. It's amazing. So I was like, all right, you have to write it down on a slip of paper, yes or no, or which side or whatever it is. And then we're going to turn them in, and then you don't have to put your name on it. It's totally risk-free. And then I sort them out into the yeses and the noes. And then after that, I'm like, all right, all the yeses, you have to go to this side of the room. And all the noes, you go to this side of the room. And something about shaking up the seating arrangement helps, too. Because when they're all, like, crowded over there and some of them are sitting on the tables and some of them are standing there and they kind of start yelling at each other across the room, it helps, you know, just kind of trying to change up the normal thing. So, yeah, the blind votes were funny. I did euthanasia, actually, and that was an amazing one because the sophomores have most of them, they didn't know what the word meant. They had not thought of it before. They were all checked out and squared away on abortion. But I came in and I pitched this. We were talking about emotional appeal. So I came in and told this very sad story and, you know, and should we take the life? And yes, we should. You know, yeah. And so anyway, and then we had a debate for like, I don't know, it probably went for like 2 weeks because it's only a 2-day-a-week class. But it was great. And by the end, they'd actually thought through it and you had ended, thankfully, most of them had changed their minds. But anyway, doing the blind vote thing can be kind of, and it's kind of fun too, but I will still get papers that say, I don't know. It's like someone who still can't force themselves to just say what they think about something. Silly topics. If you can't make them have opinions about your lit, make them fight about cowboy boots or thick versus thin crust pizza. And those can be great because, again, the students see them as a little bit more risk-free. Like, I can go on the record about crusts of pizza, and it's all right. But for lots of kids, I think expressing an opinion, especially about lit or about poetry or something, it's like asking them to sing in public for some kids. And, you know, it's just they don't feel comfortable. So if you can get them comfortable doing it, you know, about pizza and about cowboy boots, and then they all think it's funny because you pick the little sort of, you know, kid who wouldn't be caught dead near a cowboy boot and you make him defend cowboy boots and, you know, and then they think it's funny. And again, it's risk-free. So it kind of gets the ball rolling. And this year, my sophomore class that I taught rhetoric to, we started with those kinds of things. And honestly, by the end of the year, they came galloping in one day and they were like, "We know what we want to fight about." And I was like, "Great, what do you want to fight about?" And it was a poem from American Lit that they had just been fighting about in American Lit. And I'd never seen the poem before in my life. And I was like, "This is awesome." So yeah. And they just went for the whole period. And, you know, I had boys that I never would have dreamed in a million years. They'd be like, "Yes, but look at stanza 11. Because I think, you know, and it was fantastic. And I really didn't have to do much. Like, I would come in and push and I'd ask questions and stuff, but it was great. And so I think all of those, you know, sure, discussing pizza is probably not on your curriculum objectives, but it pays off in the end if you can get them to just get comfortable with it. And then near and dear to their heart topics, I have found that that is almost always music. So that's something that they care a lot about, right? High school students, they have their bands and their songs, and they kind of put them on as an accessory, like, "This defines me, this is who I am." And so that can be but that's one that they actually care more about than almost anything else in the world, because abstract concepts, you know, politics is very not real to them, but music, by golly, I won't give up this song. You know, I love this song. So make them talk about it. Like, make them talk about the music style. Make them talk about the lyrics. Make them talk about, is this a worthwhile genre? Whatever. And they will get fired up about it. So when I say music, I'm meaning like pop music, like their bands, the songs they like. If I tried to make them talk about Bach, we would not get anywhere. So then shaping opinions in older and more vocal classes. So vocal classes meaning they're comfortable saying what they think. So now you're trying to shape it, right? Because now you want them to land on the correct thing. So older classes who are more comfortable doing it, or just more vocal classes who are just there already. That's where I try and make the distinction between an opinion and a fuss. You can say what you think, but you have to have good reasons for it. So even my daughter just last night, she was flipping through a catalog and she was like, "This is so ugly." She was dead right, it was. But I said, "So why is it ugly? What makes it ugly?" You know, like, just, do you have a reason, or are you just kind of like, "Because it's ugly." Anyway, she's like, "Because it looks like someone took their grandma's tea cozy and tried to make it into a vest." And I was like, "Good. You have..." It's like, "You are correct. Also points for metaphor." So, but anyway, just make them say why. You know, they say something random. "That's ugly. I hate that. I don't like the other thing." They will do that all day long. So just ask them why. You know, do you have a reason for that, or are you just being a little dork? Okay. Is the opinion grounded in the text, like in Lit, or in the data? Like, can you demonstrate this? And I might disagree with you, but is it anchored there? Like, you want them turning back to the text if you know, whatever. So if they're not willing to do that, then they're just fussing, right? I hate Pride and Prejudice, and it's like, you probably didn't read it, did you? Do you know anything about Pride and Prejudice? So make them say it from the text, and then whatever. I might think you're wrong, but I'm still going to give you a good grade on that essay if you have good reasons, or, you know, at least you tried to have good reasons. Is the opinion principled and consistent? So that's where, just kick the tires. Just see if they mean it all the way around. Like, do they actually think, do you really think that? Do you think it in other cases? So if they say, "This is a dumb poem," and you say, "Why is it dumb?" "Because it makes no sense." Then you think, "Okay, what's your favorite song on the radio right now? Does it make sense? And why or why not? Like, why are you holding this one up to this standard and not this other thing?" So just, is it principled? Do you have any good reason for it? And is it consistent? Like, do you carry that principle across the board and make them be consistent, or show them that you're going to have to give up one or the other? And then, is this opinion capable of nuance? So, for instance, I don't like Milton, but I can appreciate Milton. Like, I can appreciate the poetry. Some of it is stunning, and I can get that. At the same time, I'm like, blah, I don't like Milton. But it's not like it's all worthless. There's no point in ever reading it. That would be just a fuss, right? There's nuance there. Like, I can appreciate the poetry. I can appreciate the imagination. I can appreciate a lot of it. I get annoyed at his little pompous attitude. But, make distinctions. So I want the students to be able to do that as well. So, anyhow, that is what I have to say about developing opinions in your classes. Thank you very much.